Now, usually these videos or podcasts are short and punchy and funny. Well, today they're neither going to be short or funny, but they will be punchy. That's what I can promise, is that we'll pack a wallop today. I'm here with my new friend, Davis Yunce. I need to make sure I get the last name right. But so what's great is we're already in the same kind of networks, the same kind of broad circle of people that are connected. But we also are from this same area here right now.
That's right.
And mutual friends, too, including Scott Dunford, who is my co-host on the Missions podcast every Sunday night at 7 p.m. And we're appreciative of him. And he saw that we were together recently doing something on local TV here, and he said, "Hey, it's Davis." So we definitely wanted to bring you in and do something a little bit more. So Davis, thanks for being here, or our Davis. We'll just go with Davis, right? So glad you could join us here. And for our audience members that might not be familiar with you and your work, you're doing a lot of important things in law, but you're also doing media hits pretty often. Tell us about Davis.
Yeah, so first of all, I'm a Christian. I was raised in a Christian
home. Good answer.
I came from a really neat background. Homeschooled most of my life, and so after undergrad at Liberty University,
Flames. Sorry,
that's
I keep
right.
it.
That's right. I know it's all singing good stuff. My song. These are yeah. the connections we have, right? So then I came back to Pennsylvania, went to Dickinson Law School here in Pennsylvania. 9/11 happened when I was in law school, so I felt it was my time to serve. So that's what I did. I went into the Air Force as a commissioned officer, as a JAG, and served on active duty for about 12 years, and then came back, brought my family back home to Pennsylvania to work for the Pennsylvania National Guard for a couple of years. And then in 2015, I shifted into private practice as an attorney. Since 2019, I've had my own law firm. And we really focus a lot on military law, but take a particular interest in religious freedom and really how to impact at the national level, at the military level, within the federal government, and other ways that we can, policies that relate to religious freedom and how we weave that into policy as it impacts service members and other folks that are serving our country.
Yeah, but you know, we're here in the headquarters of an international mission sending agency. There's real persecution in the world. We don't have religious liberty issues here in the U.S., though. I mean, we have a First Amendment. What are you talking about?
Right. And unfortunately, we know that's not true. And there are times, you know, there are times culturally where the pendulum swings. And so that's where we spend a lot of our time and focus as a law firm, working through those issues and also thinking about advocacy is how we interact with bringing Christian principles to the world, because the reality is, even in a nation like the United States with the First Amendment, there are conflicts between traditional biblical Christian teaching and what the world is telling us they want, or what they believe is right today. So it's a challenge even here.
And how did you end up using this as a public platform too? Is it just because of the nature of the legal work that you're doing that you end up needing to have more of a public-facing persona, or you're just passionate, you want to spread influence of good Christian thinking on these types of issues?
Yeah, it's a great question. I really never thought the public advocacy piece would be part of this until it was kind of forced on me. And it really started with a group of Navy SEALs, believe it or not, that legal and just sort of typical administrative solutions was not going to be the answer for these Christian men. And they needed help. So they needed resources. They needed people to understand their story and what they were trying to do. And so that's when kind of this media presence started. And I very quickly realized there are times when you have to tell the American people, you have to tell other Christians what's going on so they understand it, and not only praying for it, but providing real support as we think about these cultural issues.
So at the time we're having this conversation, the assassination of Charlie Kirk is maybe 2 weeks in the rearview mirror, not long. We don't want to date this conversation too much. Maybe people are listening to this years from now.
Right.
So maybe your initial reaction to that, but then what have you been thinking? What's been your headspace since then? And that is relevant to some of the things we want to press deeper into about the deeper cultural rifts that are in our nation if we want to fulfill the Great Commission here among our people.
Right. Man, there's so much there, but I do think it's really a a question that isn't limited just to the moment when we think about our Christian faith, whether it's mission works or missions work or other things that we're doing as Christians, when we're taking what we're doing into the world and interacting with culture. And so, you know, my first reaction to what happened to Charlie Kirk was really why, right? And I think that's a very natural reaction, yeah. And not just from a spiritual perspective, but just sort of that gut reaction of why. Why did this have to happen? Why did this have to happen to a young man?
Because he was effective.
And I think that's the answer, right? Yeah. And that goes into the headspace that I've been in. It's something we had, you know, a little bit of a conversation about, but it really is, you know, I think we miss as Christians, and we have a tendency to put things into boxes or categories.
Yeah.
And when we do that, we miss the larger spiritual battles that are happening.
Yeah.
And I really do think what's happening with Charlie Kirk involves a spiritual battle, because we're seeing religion clash. Yeah. We're seeing secular humanism, really worship of man. That's really what all idol worship comes down to. We're seeing that clash with traditional Christian faith in a very public way, because there's so many belief systems that are out there that people want to call secular. Mm. They don't want to call it religion. They don't want to talk about it that way, but it directly clashes with traditional biblical teaching.
Yeah.
And what we're here for, what this organization is here to do, to spread the gospel. So that direct conflict with the gospel is what we're seeing. And unfortunately, with Charlie Kirk, it turned violent. But I think that's a lot of what I've been thinking about. And it does tie into other work that I do, because it's there constantly. Yeah.
So let's press into that. So what I didn't hear you mention was left, right.
Right.
Not that that doesn't matter. I think on some level it does. You know, Aaron Wren has his positive world, neutral world, negative world kind of paradigm. Playing with that, I do think in the negative world, you know, going back 30, 40 years, where there was less volatility, less polarization, I think it was a lot easier to say, you know, the Christian message is something that transcends all of politics and these sorts of partisan debates. And of course it does. Obviously we're dealing with timeless transcultural truth. But politics meant something different 30 or 40 years ago too. I mean, we're debating two sides of the same coin, you know, like what's the marginal tax rate going to be? Like it,
absolutely.
It wasn't, you know, basically the right to end human life or pervert the image of God any way I want to versus preserving any modicum of goodness, truth, and beauty. So the lines are drawn now. It's not just that the rift between those two sides is deeper, but what I heard you say wasn't right, left. What I heard you say was also, no, there's a spiritual battle happening here. It's two rival religions. So what are, instead of thinking along party lines, because like I have a problem with everybody.
Right.
I have more of a problem with some than others, but the rift you would say is between two religious systems, or the name of the show, two worldviews. What are those systems?
Absolutely. I mean, and of course, everything we contextualize to kind of the modern era, right? So this is the era that we're living in. So we do think of terms that way, but we can think bigger picture. So we have traditional biblical Christian faith. We have, you know, gospel-centered ministry. We have what the church has taught. And then we have different eras. And we can look at this. You can see this history in world missions as well. You know, there were pagan cultures that had direct clashes, sometimes violent clashes, with the Christian faith. And we're seeing the same thing. So for me, doing what I do, interacting with the people that I do, I see really, I would label it secular humanism, right? That's kind of the label that's out there. But it really is a worldview that causes people to worship man ultimately. And we can see a trend in that almost always leads to tyranny in the culture, whether it's cultural tyranny through systems or the government itself. When you worship man instead of God, there's this tendency to elevate government and to elevate men, whether it's scientists or experts or otherwise, for solutions. And that often runs directly in contradiction and creates conflict between traditional Christian faith and biblical teaching.
Mm. To go back to Charlie Kirk for a moment, and you know, it's bigger than just him, but honestly, we're going to be talking about this for years to come. Like this is a generation shaping event. COVID was a generation shaping event. 9/11 was a generation shaping event. You know, MLK's assassination, JFK. So like this is going to shape the psyche of this entire age cohort that's up and running, up and coming right now. he did not. It's funny. I heard some people in my feed say, you know, like, well, I'm really grateful for his witness. I'm really grateful that he was so outspoken with his faith. I just wish he weren't so political.
Right.
Which is sort of, that would be like saying that, you know, I really like Davis. Mm-hmm. He's got some good thoughts about Christianity. Like, I love that he loves Jesus. He's just too legal. I think your response would be like, well, I'm a lawyer.
Right.
So, like, I feel like if you're a political activist, you're allowed to be political.
Right.
But it does seem like for him, the culture war,
right,
whatever that is, mm-hmm, was not a distraction from the gospel,
right,
but actually a direct platform for it. You know, in, right, missions, we talk about like, okay, well, English as a second language, teaching English as a second language, TESOL, that's my platform in this country.
Right.
So I can have a legitimate visa, get in there, do some good work, you know, or I have a business visa. We talk about platforms all the time. Charlie Kirk's platform was politics and culture war, interestingly.
Right.
Doesn't he know how many people he was alienating away from the gospel by being so divisive? I mean, how do we think about that? Is it a distraction or can it dovetail?
Well, I think there's a couple of different things to think about. One is a question of how does our vocation, what God calls us to do vocationally, interact with our Christian faith? And I don't think if we were honest, I mean, some people think this way, but I don't think if we're honest, we would say that our vocation shouldn't be impacted by our Christian faith. It must be.
Yeah.
If we're to live out live out God's calling, if we're to make disciples of all nations. And so what I would say to that too, the other way I would look at it is this, is would we say, because we do, there's something we tell ourselves that is critical and it's a failure, but would we say that our Christian faith should not impact our morals? No one would say that, right? But what do we hear all the time? Well, you can't legislate morality.
Right.
We hear that all the time, right?
Yeah. I tensed up as soon as he said that.
Yeah, right. Like, yeah.
You can only legislate morality.
You can only legislate morality because every law is based on a moral principle. It comes from a moral foundation. It comes from a worldview. Why do we have speed limits? I mean, I could write, as an attorney and a Christian, I could write a dissertation on the moral basis for speed limits. And we could debate whether or not, you know, it should be 70 or 65. But there is a moral principle bound. Ultimately, you could look at it as a preservation of life.
Yeah, it's the sixth commandment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so if we can understand that, if we can take a step back, and there are, maybe you feel this is harsh, but I think sometimes the Christians and the Christian church can buy into lies. I think in America in particular, more so than other parts of the world, comfort, having a nation that has a lot of reference to God and a creator and our founding documents as a nation creates a level of comfort with the American church. And so we think we can kind of exist in a world where we don't have to offend anyone with our faith.
Right.
And I think what Charlie Kirk demonstrated is a willingness to say, when we're talking about truth, basic biblical truth, a creator God who created men and women, something as simple as that actually creates a platform for the gospel, because people are going to interact with truth and they're going to have to confront the truth. And then that allows God to work and the gospel to be spread. So it may seem controversial. It may feel uncomfortable for people,
right,
but I think he was called to do that. And we are seeing now the reaction to his death, the memorial service and other things. Take politics out of it. Mm. The gospel was clearly being shared
a lot
by people who we might not have expected to share it, and certainly wouldn't have expected it from political leaders on a national platform like that. And their focus was, they weren't talking about an election, they were talking about the gospel. So many of them,
you know, because the line is always, well, they're just saying that to get elected. Well, nobody's up for election right now,
right?
So maybe it was sincere.
Maybe it was.
I want it to be.
I want it to be. And, you know, that's one of the things I was talking to someone, a dear friend yesterday. I had breakfast with him, and he's very, views politics very differently than I do. I'll say it that way.
And your friends?
Very dear friends.
So you can love your neighbor and have opinions.
Absolutely.
It's a glorious thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, but you know, one of the things I said is, I said, well, you know, I don't think you should be too worried about them, their willingness to claim the gospel, to talk about Christ and to share the gospel in that way, because God's going to hold them accountable. If they don't live that out, if they're claiming in the name of Christ, they're doing these things, and then they're not, there will be accountability for them as well.
Right.
And that's a, I mean, that's something we can be praying for and a powerful thing as we think about this.
Yeah, that's right. Nominal Christianity is sort of this great specter that everyone's afraid of. Like, well, we don't know the state of their hearts. Are they truly regenerate? I don't know.
Right.
But okay, the glass is, you could either say it's half full or half empty. I'm going to choose to view that as half full. And when we're from our vantage point here, sending missionaries all over the world,
right.
We'd be lying if we said that sharing the gospel and winning hearts and minds to Christ and planting churches is not easier in, for instance, the Islamic world,
right,
where there's no foundation to build on,
right,
or in the Hindu world than it is in, you know, Latin America, where you have folk Catholicism, folk nominal Catholicism.
Like, sure,
you do have more of a starting point. Now you have to unteach some wrong things along the way, but you know, I want to view any presence of Christianity as a good starting point. I'm not upset when people start dropping the name Jesus, unless it's blasphemous. But I'm excited about that. And there's an example for this within missionary history. I mean, look at William Carey, somebody who's preaching the gospel, planting churches, translating scripture, but he's also a social activist in India,
right,
as a foreign national from England,
right,
advocating that they stop widow burning.
Right.
And they eventually do. And out of a lot of his legacy comes what we would call today modern India. You don't have a Gandhi without first having a William Carey.
That's right.
And so somebody asked me recently, like, why, what are you passionate about, Alex? Like, what are you after, you know, in combining like this cultural conversation with missions and the Great Commission? Like, and I said, look, what we need, in my opinion, and I'd love for your reaction. I'd love to hear your reaction, rather. We need missionaries with the heart of activists, like a William Carey, somebody who's going to a faraway place, preaching the gospel, planting churches, making disciples, but then also is not afraid to shrink back from the implications of that gospel for all of life.
Right.
And
then
secondly, we need activists with the heart of missionaries.
Absolutely.
We need somebody who's not just going to debate, you know, how many bureaucrats can dance on the head of a needle. You know, what the marginal tax rate should be for this group of people in this bracket, but to actually use that as a platform for the gospel. People like Charlie Kirk, people like our friend Dusty Devers.
Right.
Those two things don't have to be at odds. What are your thoughts with that? Because I do still feel like this is probably changing now with Charlie Kirk. But we've programmed ourselves to think in these little compartments for so long. And yet when I look at the Great Commission, when I look at Matthew 28, which we believe as a mission agency where I serve,
right,
that Christ has all authority. So you can't separate culture from the gospel.
Right.
The gospel directly speaks to that. So am I right in wanting those things on both ends to happen?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And there's a lot of different ways to think about that. One of the things I think about is this idea that if we, again, this is somewhat unique to America. It's not only in America. And I think, you know, the United Kingdom and some other places are in Europe are struggling with some of this as well. We buy into this mentality sometimes as Christians that, you know, being kind or being nice or being polite is the 11th commandment.
Winsome,
right? And the challenge with that is we're not bringing the love of Christ to people who need it. I mean, people are dying. They're dying and they're living with the consequences of sin and the chaos that comes along with that. And it is not loving to withhold all of Scripture and the truth of God's word and what God's plan is, the blessings that come from living a life in accordance with God's creative order. So I think that, you know, when we think of, it's very easy. And again, I'm coming from a primarily American context. So a lot of this I'm going to talk about in that way, but I know churches, I've been part of churches that wouldn't hesitate to send money to and fully support a missionary getting a business visa to go into and start a bakery or start some other business in a nation where direct proselytizing would be perceived as illegal. And yet that same church would be uncomfortable sharing the gospel in a secular setting, mm-hmm. you know, at work or and at a school board meeting or interacting with their neighbors, they'd be yeah. afraid to talk about the gospel themselves.
Yeah.
And that's a fascinating thing. I mean, even people I know that have gone on mission trips to support those missionaries that are engaging in technically illegal activity in that country.
Right.
And then they're uncomfortable talking to their neighbors,
yeah.
you know, that are living in a manner that's inconsistent with God's created order. So that's a fascinating thing. So, you know, what is it? What is our failing as Christians? Why have we pulled back from that? And I think historically, we're reaping the consequences of much of that in the United States and other places in the world, because we're not the Christians that are there, even those shared cultural foundations. We've neutered them ourselves. We've taken away the cultural impact, the positive cultural impact. Was it Christopher Hitchens that was talking about his desire to live in a nation that's influenced by Christian traditions, even though he's a renowned yeah. atheist right. and bemoaning the loss of Christian yeah. faith traditions in society?
Or even Richard Dawkins saying, like, I'm culturally Christian.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Fascinating. Doesn't, you know, claims not to believe in God at all.
Vindicating presuppositionalists everywhere.
Absolutely. Once and for all.
Yeah.
Right? Once and for all. But so I think those are all the things I think about. But I think you're absolutely right. If we have political activists that are just using Christianity, you know, as a bludgeon.
Yeah, we don't want that. No.
But if you're sincerely trying to honor Christ and speak truth and willing to go into dark places, like unfortunately many universities in the United
yeah.
States,
yeah.
To talk about controversial things like God created the world and created men and women, you know, that's what we need. And we need Christians who aren't afraid to do that, but base it on that biblical foundation.
Which is all just to say there's no neutrality.
There is no neutrality.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about it. I think you're right. I think we're very willing to send the gospel overseas. I mean, sometimes, you know, we could be doing a better job of that too.
Absolutely.
But in principle, everyone supports that. We do hold back though, and we self-censor in the workplace or in the public arena mm-hmm. or on social media. We don't want to offend, you know, we want to pull people along. I got into a little bit of a Facebook argument with a friend, a good guy, a godly guy, but the other week, who was attempting to argue biblically that open gospel proclamation was only for the apostles and not for us.
Oh, wow.
And he said, do you see anywhere in the New Testament where when there's open gospel proclamation, they're only talking to Jews. It's just Jews trying to win over other Jews and Hellenistic Jews in the book of Acts. They never do that to the pagans. I'm like, brother, do you even Acts 17?
Right.
Right. Or 14?
Right.
So there is this way that we've sort of trained ourselves to let ourselves off the hook. So what does it look like then to recognize there's no neutrality? I want to embrace gospel proclamation and all of the effects of having a robust Christian lens on reality. Mm-hmm. And I want to bring that into my legal practice. I want to bring that into my military career. I want to bring that into my I work for a big corporation. HR department's breathing down my spine. It's all I can do to keep them off my back. How do you really do that? And I know there's risks involved in that.
Absolutely.
Like, how does that look? But then also, like, there are risks. You can't live without risk, right? Like, you might get canceled. You might lose everything. That happens.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've spent probably the most time thinking about all of this. So
absolutely.
What's your perspective?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I have to constantly do as an attorney, whether it's representing a military member or someone else who works for the federal government, representing someone who may have gotten fired over a post positive of Charlie Kirk from a particular, you know, business.
Hypothetically. Not that that happened.
There's a lot that goes into it. One of the things I say to men, particularly young men that I speak to, is what are you doing and building in your life now so that you have a foundation that you're capable and you feel capable of taking a stand when you're called to take a stand?
Mm.
So I think one of the things we have to do is, you know, as Christian men, speaking to the men, as Christian men, you have to start with saying, okay, What is my foundation? Because mm-hmm. I can't, and again, this is maybe a military perspective, but you don't just go and fight a war. You don't just go and do something without training for it. You train for it. Sometimes you train for it for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And then you know, I spent 12 years on active duty in the military. I deployed for 7 months.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what I mean by that is you have to start with a foundation. You have to think about all aspects of life. You know, do you try to eat healthy? Do you try to exercise? Do you try to take care of yourself? Are you financially?
Don't get on fights on Facebook preaching the gospel to people, but you're addicted to porn.
Right. Like, exactly. Stop it. Exactly. Stop it. Because you're compromising. Not only are you compromising your witness if that comes out, but you yourself are compromised. You're of two minds if you're not doing that. So you really have to, you have to have a foundation. I just believe very strongly in this, because then what's going to happen is there's going to be a moment as a Christian, and sometimes they're very small things, sometimes they're very big things, where you're called to take a stand. You're called to do something for the gospel, for the kingdom. And if you haven't built a foundation, you're not going to be ready to do it. And so, again, it's one of those things where God doesn't call every single person to some big, bold moment. That's right. Not necessarily what he calls us to.
And that's a good point. It's a, right. It's a thousand tiny moments.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then sometimes the big moment will come.
Yeah.
And you have to be prepared for that. And, you know, sometimes we're not, and that's the best part, right?
Yeah.
When we're most humble, when we're most broken, when we're leaning on Christ, we're not going to think we're ready. We're going to feel, if we look to ourselves, completely overwhelmed in that moment, don't have the answers. Christ does. But I think that's the starting point, because then when something happens, if you're called, you know, if you don't have a little bit of savings, if you don't have a way to make a living, but except for a corporate job, if you're overextended, if you have lots of debt, like, you all of a sudden you can't take care of your family if you lose your job.
Yeah.
And so that's going to make that decision very, very different. You know, for me, I mean, I literally got a phone call at 11:45 at night on a Tuesday from a Christian attorney who called me and said, "Hey, I've got a group of 60 Navy SEALs. They're being told they're going to get court-martialed because of their religious faith. They're seeking a conscience-based accommodation in their military service, and they really think they're going to be court-martialed." And, you know, I just laugh about that, because I'd started my own law firm, so I was working for myself. So it was myself, my wife, and God that were going to be, you know, my fellow elders at my church that I was going to be accountable to for what I was doing. And I said, you know, I can help. Let me meet with these guys. So I met with them, and that's, you know, that's kind of where my public work blossomed from that, because we realized very quickly with a couple of pastors, Jeff Durbin from Arizona was there as well. We realized we needed support for these guys. The public needed to know what was being done to them, the persecution they were facing because of their faith. So that went from a Friday meeting to being on Tucker Carlson when he was on Fox on a Monday night. And I felt completely, you know, completely overwhelmed by that. It was that quick.
So you weren't doing media hits before that. So you went from just
normal
attorney hanging out in PA
to
Fox News.
Yeah, to Fox News, Tucker Carlson. You know, I spoke to him for 5 minutes on a phone call before. Yeah, and he's just like, "I'm going to tee you up. Say whatever you want to say. I'm a Christian too." That's what he said to me. "I'm a Christian too. Say whatever you want to say."
Yeah.
And so, you know, I share that example to say God had orchestrated a series of things in my life, my wife's life, where that made perfect sense. I was prepared for that.
Yeah.
And God had kind of built me for that. And so there's things that happen that God does for all of us that help us prepare for that. So I know that's kind of a long way of answering your question, but I think we all need to be constantly thinking about and praying, what is God calling me to do? What skills do I have? Is it just taking a public stand? Maybe it is taking a public stand in my workplace, and praying through very carefully, you know, when to take that stand and how to approach it. Because one of the things, as an attorney, I have a lot of conversations with my clients, because sometimes people will call me and they've done something very foolish. Even as a Christian, even if they were trying to think through it as a Christian perspective, they've done something criminal. They've broken a law. They've done something where there's going to need to be consequences for that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes it's counting that cost and making sure we represent Christ well. So, you know, I represented a man named Michael Cassidy. He's the Navy reservist who went to the Iowa State Capitol and he tore down the statue. And, you know, there's a lot of funny things about that story, but he tore down that statue of Bayomet because he was so just convicted that it was wrong.
Yeah.
But he tore it down. And the part of the story that doesn't always get told is he took a garbage bag with him. He cleaned up the mess.
Turned himself in. Put everything
together. He turned himself in and he said, "This is what I've done. You can probably pull the camera footage. I noticed there's a camera there.
Yeah.
You can see what I did. And I'm prepared to face the consequences, you know?" And then he called me and said, how bad is this going to be? But I say that to say, like, you know,
ultimately, he's a service member as well.
He was a Navy reservist. So yeah. ultimately, you know, he was subject to the jurisdiction of the state of Iowa, and right. he did damage property that belonged to someone else.
Right.
And so, you know, that was part of counting the cost for that. But that was something he felt very convicted in the moment to do. And so that's just an example of that. But not everyone is called to go there and do that. Not everyone yeah. is expected to do that. But, you know, some of it are small things that impact us as we're growing up. You know, we laugh about that. I moved to Pennsylvania as a kid when I was 8 years old. Well, at that time, homeschooling was not only not popular in Pennsylvania, yeah. it was all but illegal.
Barely legal.
You know, yeah. and so, you know, I remember very distinctly my parents being involved with the Homeschool Legal Defense Association mm-hmm. and being part of fighting for changes to the homeschooling law in Pennsylvania. And so that absolutely impacted me when it comes to, there was no separation of culture and and faith because the school district was coming into the home. I mean, people don't know how bad it was, but you had to sign, never forget this, you had to sign over authority to the local school district that said, as a parent, they can come into your home at any time with Child Protective Services unannounced. And if you are not following the schedule that the school district sets out for the school and not doing the curriculum, they can take your kids away and you're not allowed to fight it. I mean, so if you're supposed to be doing math at 10:15 and they come in unannounced and you can't prove you were doing math at 10:15, they're threatening to take your kids. Not every school district in Pennsylvania was that bad because it was a little bit of the Wild West when it came to that. But that's how bad it was where we were. And that's why people were fighting it. But there was
funny
no separation.
The original vanguard of the homeschooling movement was a lot of left of center people.
Right.
Originally.
Right. Absolutely.
And now after COVID, now it's the fun thing to do. Everyone's doing
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. Everyone. Now it's popular.
Regardless of worldview. Yeah.
Right.
So are there, in your view, certain fields or occupations at this point in our current culture, you know, America as a mission field, that a conscientious Christian just can't be in? Like, can you be in the military and not be faced with that crisis? Can you practice law and not be faced with that? Can you hold public office and not be faced with that? Obviously, you know, there's certain professions that like Christians shouldn't be, you know, loan sharks. They shouldn't be operating casinos, right?
Sure, sure.
But even beyond that, how hard, if pretending I was a missionary coming into America to be a missionary and I'm looking for a job to take as a platform, are there some that I should just avoid?
I think there are some that are very challenging. I mean, one of the, for me personally, I had very strong religious convictions related to the COVID mandate in the military. So I myself was had a conscious objection to it.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is the law that's been on the books for a long time in the United States, if the military just followed the law, they could have easily granted
most. I'll just say for the record, I'm against COVID as well. COVID, I'm against it.
Right.
I dislike it.
No, but you know, my frustration because, you know, understand at that point in my military career, I'd over 19 years in, you know, and the military has this sort of all or nothing retirement proposition. You get to 20 years or you don't. And so I say that to say, you know, I had this conscience-based objection to it and I was denied. And so it took federal court, it took an injunction in federal court for me to get to 20 years myself. So it was a very personal thing to me. But I say that to say, you know, there are institutional things that make it very challenging, I think, for Christians. Sometimes that ebbs and flows depending on what the leadership structure looks like. But when I sit down with young men that are thinking about serving in the military, any young people that are thinking about serving in the military, I ask a lot of questions about why. What is your motivation to do it? And I think that's really the question for Christians in a lot of professions. Why is it you want to do this? Because absolutely, I mean, lawyers as a whole, high divorce rates, high alcoholism rates, high drug addiction rates, it can be a very demanding profession, and there can be a lot of calls for moral, ethical compromise and, you know, seeking the win or seeking advantage for your clients and things like that. So it can be extremely challenging. But my challenge is if you're going to do it, why? Why do you want to go to law school? Why do you want that training? Is it just about money or prestige? If that's the case, it's going to be very difficult for you as a Christian because you're going to be presented with those compromises. The same is true of the military. I think that would be extremely difficult. And, you know, politics, I think anyone that goes into politics should look at it as a very temporary thing. Honestly, making a career out of politics, I don't know how you do that successfully.
Insider trading.
Insider trading.
That's
exactly.
Now, I heard on a podcast this morning, I thought this was really helpful, having this similar conversation about, all right, like, when do you pick a fight? When do you stand up? Mm-hmm. And the problem for us as believers, this is true of conservative people in general, people that are conservative dispositionally, but especially of Christians in a place like the United States. You know, we want to get out of this controversy as soon as possible so I can go back to my kids' t-ball game, right? We want to get back to normal life. I love my normal life. It's great. But sometimes, you know, in the words of the conversation between Aragorn and Theoden, open war is upon you, whether you seek it or not. And what this individual was saying that I thought was insightful was you want to decide to pick the right fights from now. So you're not going to pick every fight.
That's right.
Right. Nobody's perfectly anti-fragile in every capacity unless you're just completely self-sufficient financially and otherwise. Right. Everyone at some level has to consider what's the cost to my family, what's the cost to my church, what's the cost to all these categories. But if I'm going to take a stand, pick the right fight, pick a winnable fight.
Yes.
And pick a fight that will set me up on the best platform for the next fight. Set me up to take on a bigger stand that will affect more people than just me. I thought that was really insightful. How would you approach someone who right now, a lot of people are feeling this.
Right.
We're seeing open violence against people of any kind of traditional or conservative or especially Christian belief.
Right.
Open violence from this radical secular humanist death cult.
Right.
And they're like, all right, it's time to get busy living, get busy dying.
Absolutely.
How do I know what kind of fight to pick? And of course, metaphorically fight. Nobody's saying actually go out and start brawling in the street.
Of course.
And we're in fact saying don't do that.
Right.
That's exactly what I think the enemy wants you to do.
Absolutely.
Don't do that. Mm-hmm. So how do you think through that decision matrix?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think God, you know, God calls us to be in a mindset where we're furthering the kingdom, we're sharing the gospel with whatever it is we're doing, right? And so I think thinking in terms of, can I have an impact? Has God positioned me, whether it's skill set, whether it's a platform, whatever it is, has God put me in a position where I can have an impact, even if it's a very small impact? It could be a community impact, a neighborhood impact, but has God put me in a position where I can have an impact? And if the answer is yes, and I see that, and I see a path to do that, then that's how we build. And I do think America as a nation, we have a very short view of history. We're a very young nation globally, and I think other nations do a better job of thinking long term. But I think even the American church, we don't think long term. We don't think decades. We don't think generationally, unfortunately. And I think we need that type of thinking, because that's, you know, what you're talking about, what that podcast was sharing is, we can make advancements for the gospel. We can say this far and no farther, you know, for the sake of our children. And then maybe that's a battle our children don't have to fight, right? Mm-hmm. So just like my parents were willing to take on a fight for homeschool freedom in Pennsylvania, now it's not difficult to homeschool your children in Pennsylvania. And you know, I was able to come back. After I left active duty, I came back and I was testifying in front of the state Senate in Pennsylvania for an even important change in new legislation. And I was just building on the victories my parents had made here. And I think that's an example of that. So that generational win. So I think we can't just engage in short-term thinking. I think we can engage in long-term strategic thinking. And again, like this organization here does in missions, thinking long-term, what does this look like?
Yeah.
How do we build sustainable organizations, sustainable churches, sustainable families. And I think that's the way to think about it. So what are those wins? And as an attorney, we talk about that all the time. There's cases where we say, this is a case we believe we can win. And when we win, this is going to set a powerful precedent for other Christians and other people that are there. And sometimes, you know, there are some, you know, clients or potential clients I'll talk to, and I'll say, okay, because of this sin or this past thing you did in your military career, you don't have an unblemished record. So I'm going to help you because you're doing the right thing here. I'm going to help you, but you're not going to be the public face of this battle because there's baggage, there's sin baggage or other baggage that comes along with it that isn't there. And that to me also goes in what I talked about earlier, building this foundation.
Yeah.
You know, we do, none of us are without sin. None of us are perfect. We all have, you know, mistakes that we've made. We all carry that baggage of sin with us, but in Christ, seeking that forgiveness and looking to say, okay, now I'm prepared. God can use me. And then we can have an impact as we've prepared ourselves for that. And as we think about how can we win and how does this have an impact just beyond my own situation and impact others.
So you're the American Pope for a day. and you have total charge for one day over all of American Christians. You know, I hear you saying some things like we need to be in this field and that field, but we need to preach the gospel, share the gospel. There is a certain line of thinking that sort of says just share the gospel and don't do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Let Jesus figure out the rest providentially and don't polish brass on a sinking ship, right? Mm-hmm. There's that school of thought. I think you and I would agree there's limits to that.
Absolutely. Right?
Piety is awesome. Pietism that is only just me and Jesus.
Right.
And then when it's me and my neighbor, it's only his soul and not his body as well. That,
right.
That type of pietism, that dog won't hunt. So if you have total dominion over the forces of Americans, American Christians as missionaries to the place where they live, who are you telling, like, hey, we need more people here or we need fewer people here? Like, do we need more people that are just doing ordinary, beautiful Christian life, which is an awesome thing, like, you know, just singing loud when they worship in church and loving their wife and kids. And that's awesome. Do we need just more of that? And God will take that and it'll bubble up into revival and it'll be beautiful. Do we also need people with very particular vocations in law, in politics to take power, which can be a temptation, but to use power as a tool for the good of their neighbor, to bring about justice biblically under God's law, God's moral standards. How are you distributing the troops?
So I would say all of the above, and I would just start with a mission mindset focus. I would say whatever it is, whatever skill set you have, whatever you are doing vocationally, that's a mission field for a reason. And I don't care if you work for a company that's very anti-Christian in their policies and frowns on that. You can still take people to lunch. You can still go for a walk on a break. You can bring coffee to the office. You can have meaningful conversations. Mm-hmm. You can invite people to church. You can do those things. You can do them well, and you can figure out how to carefully navigate the human resources policy so you're not violating the policy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. force them to tell you no.
Well, use your liberty too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you have rights.
Use the liberty that you have and use it well. So what I would say is the first is we all need to be on missionary footage. We all need to see ourselves as called, not just, you know, not just writing a check, but actually called to be carrying out the Great Commission. And then I would say, absolutely, we need to be looking at where is their darkness? Where is their darkness where Christians have pulled back for whatever reason, and we don't see a strong Christian presence in that field, and we need to absolutely be doing that. So absolutely, we need Christian lawyers. The problem is the infrastructure isn't there. There are very few law schools that are going to prepare a Christian to practice the law consistent with their faith.
Okay.
And so I think that's the challenge. We have some great Christian
universities. If you asked me to name five Christian law schools, I couldn't.
There aren't.
Yeah.
There aren't.
Yeah.
And even, you know, and I mean, we could go into a longer discussion about accreditation and other things and how that limits what law schools can do. But that's a challenge. So we have to think, you know, what does that mean? If I'm going to say, hey, we need a new generation of Christian lawyers out there. Okay. But do we have the infrastructure in place to train them and prepare them to do that? So I think that's part of those small wins is how do we do that? So we absolutely need to be thinking about education at all levels as we do this. And we need to be preparing young, you know, the next generations to actually go into those fields and be successful. Because you can take someone like me, you know, Christian home, homeschooled, goes to Liberty University, gets a great education with a Christian worldview in political science, and then goes to a law school that was, you know, in conservative central Pennsylvania. And and if you did a left-right spectrum, I'll just tell you this, there was only one registered Republican professor in the entire law school, right? And not to make it about left and right, but but the worldview was absolutely secular humanism.
Yeah.
And so, you know, everything about the teaching came from that view.
Right.
And so if you had any other view, you were you know, that you were seen as odd, you know? Mm. And so that had an impact on me. You know, there was a constant struggle to fight through that.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been much more effective early on in my career as an attorney if I'd had a strong grounding in law and law teaching from a Christian perspective, because I had to go find that on my own.
So you think that matters? So just to press it on, so like, because the law is the law, like whether you're a Christian or not, you have to work within the confines of U.S. laws.
Sure.
Or no. Is that too simple?
That's way too simple, because it goes back to the whole morality thing we have, right? So, yeah. So again, take the United States contextually. The Constitution is a very short document.
Yeah.
It's a very limited document.
Yeah. And it's procedural law. It's not
it's
like
procedural
moral value code. Right. It's yeah.
But the men that wrote the Constitution, the men that adopted the Constitution were absolutely Christians in their worldview.
Yeah.
Now, all of them may not have had a saving knowledge of Christ. Okay. Right.
The glass was half full.
The glass was absolutely half full, because everything they did was influenced by, because they were absolutely fluent in the Bible.
Right.
They read the Bible. They knew the Bible. They understood the Bible. Other than Montesquieu, the most common book quoted in the Constitutional Convention was not just the Bible. It's actually the book of Deuteronomy specifically. Mm. Now just think about that when you think about our laws. So I say that to say the Constitution in the United States, we talk about our religious freedom and the positive things we have here.
Yeah.
It's a flawed, imperfect document written by men founded on an assumption of biblical literacy and Christian worldview. And even our founders talked about that. So when we look at our laws today in the United States, it's influenced by that. And you can go all over the world and see how laws culturally are impacted by a nation's religious heritage, whatever that nation's religious heritage is.
Always
impacts it. And so absolutely that has an impact. So if, you know, like I did, I mean, the only religion that was taught in law school I went to was secular humanism. That was it, you know, atheistic, secular humanism, that's it.
That is a religion.
That is a religion. And so it has a huge impact.
Because people lose their mind over Christian nationalism, whatever that is.
Right.
But we do have another religion that's in charge of our culture, generally speaking. It's secular humanism.
Absolutely.
So last question. What's your favorite lawyer joke?
Oh man, there are
I've always been fond of saying, like, you know, what do you call like a busload of lawyers going off a cliff? You know, it's a good start.
My favorite lawyer joke was a missionary and a lawyer arrived in heaven at the same time, right? And the theology, this is a little bad.
This is relevant.
St. Peter's there and is showing them around, and he's walking with the missionary and the lawyer. They died at the same time. So he takes the missionary to a very small, very nice, but very humble house, you know, and this wonderful missionary served on the mission field his whole life. And that's his house. And then takes him down the street, and there's this huge mansion, just this amazing estate. And the lawyer looks and says, well, what's going on? Why is this my house? He goes, well, you're the first lawyer we've ever had here.
Well, I'm going to have to rethink, you know, just constantly slamming lawyers, because you've improved my overall view of them.
Right.
Thank you for joining us. Where do you want to point people to follow your work? Or maybe they're thinking, maybe a missionary is watching, like, man, I'm in legal trouble. You have like an 800 number? Or?
Well, we do have a website. It's themilitarycouncil.com. Themilitarycouncil.com is a website. And then
there's S-E-L, not C-I-L.
Right, yes. S-E-L. And then I'm on X. I'm fairly active on X, so that's a good way to find me. And I do respond to direct messages on X. So it's just @DavisJones.
Oh, I don't even do that.
So it's at Davis Jantz on X.
Very good. Thanks for joining us,
absolutely.
Davis. And thank you for joining us as well. We'll see you on the next episode.